you missed the Emmys last week, well, you're not alone. The preeminent TV awards show celebrated its 75th airing with a record low viewing audience. 4.3 million people watched. Well, what gives? Well, for one, the Emmys typically air in September, but you may remember last year's hot labor summer, writers and actors striking. Right. So cue the Emmys moving to January during NFL playoffs. Good luck getting Americans' eyeballs against that programming. Our next guest has thoughts about how the Emmys could be improved to better match how TV itself has evolved in the age of streaming. And we're going to talk about some ways modern series producers for shows like True Detective and Fargo are shaking up established formulas. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Did you watch the Emmys? Do you always watch? And do you have thoughts about the broadcast itself? Curious if you liked it, and if you liked who won. Were the winners and losers deserving? And what would make you more interested to watch future Emmys broadcasts? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page, email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jen Chaney is a TV critic for Vulture and New York Magazine. Jen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Shereen. Nice to talk with you.
It's nice to talk to you, too. Before we get to the fixes you have for ideas about the Emmys, can we talk about what went wrong with this milestone 75th Emmys?
Well, you summarized it quite well at the top there. First of all, it was postponed. It was obviously supposed to be in September, as it normally is, but it was pushed to January because of the writers and actors strikes. And that January timing put it up against an NFL playoff game on NBC, which is always going to capture more eyeballs than anything else on television. And there was also some coverage of the Iowa election situation that was going on that night as well. And then on top of it, I just think a lot of people who might normally watch the Emmys had no idea that it was even on that night. I don't think CBS did the best job of promoting it. And so I think that helps to explain why the viewer numbers were so low this year. It was the lowest in the history of the entire Emmys broadcast. Mm-hmm. But I do think award shows in general haven't been as widely watched as they used to be. The Oscars and the Grammys last year saw a bit of an uptick from where they were during the lows of the pandemic years, but the Emmys hasn't had that kind of a bump yet. And I think award shows have to work a little harder to make sure that people are invested in them and actually want to watch them live.
Have the Emmy Awards broadcasts ever been really good TV, in your opinion?
I mean, I don't think this year's was bad TV. No. I think a lot of the people who were rewarded were not unexpected. You know, you had the dominance of Succession, The Bear, and Beef, which was all pretty predictable, if you even pay casual attention to this. But the way they did the broadcast, they honored a lot of older shows. And one thing that I really liked that they did in a couple of instances is they paired sort of newer stars with older stars, like they had Taraji P. Henson and Joan Collins, Joan Collins from Dynasty and Taraji having played Cookie, who's sort of a parallel character on an Empire. I love that idea. I think they could do more with that in the future. But I think it's just puzzling because we engage with television more than any other pop cultural medium. We all watch it on average of 2 or 3 hours a day, according to statistics. So we should have a built-in interest in knowing what wins these awards. It's just a question of figuring out how to capitalize on that.
Yeah, it is interesting that we spend so much time watching TV, and yet this doesn't have that same kind of oomph that some of the awards shows do. What has been a winning element or formula in the past?
I mean, you know, I think, and this is something you kind of can't get around, that people just were more accustomed to tuning into to watching things live than we are now. I think people, oftentimes they don't even turn on something like the Emmys broadcast and they just look at their Twitter feeds to find out what's happening and find out what the highlights are, which I guess is a way to save some time. But, I think, again, like really trying to emphasize how much people love these shows and that they're giving awards to these shows and you want to tune in to find out what's going to win the same way you do for the Oscars. And I do think this year, the timing made this an especially bad year. But as I mentioned in a piece that I wrote last week for Vulture, you know, I really do wonder if we need to change the schedule of the Emmys in general. You know, there's sort of an outlier award that's given out in September. The qualification period runs from June 1 of a year to May 31st of the next, which used to make sense when the broadcast networks fall seasons went from September to May, and they were sort of the dominant force in television, but that hasn't been the case in a long, long time. And so even in a good year, by the time we get around to giving Emmys to some of these shows, it feels like we were talking about them 5 years ago. And so I think the most important thing the Emmys can do is try to feel as current to the moment and as immediate as television does for most of us who watch it.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there was no red carpet this year either, right?
No, there was a red carpet. They did not show coverage of it.
Not on TV.
Pre-show. They did on E!
Okay.
And they did online, but they didn't do it on CBS. And normally the network that's broadcasting a show will do some sort of red carpet, you know, prologue, but they did not do that because football.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think that hurt them too, the red carpet?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a double-edged sword. On one hand, I think they should have been helped by having football as a lead-in.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think having a little bit of a red carpet show, even if it's a half hour, helps kind of, you know, hype it up a little bit and prepare people to watch it and get in the mood. And yeah, they just didn't really have that, which just ties into what I was saying about how they just didn't really promote it very much this year.
Yeah. Well, as for things you liked about this broadcast, you wrote about a series of speeches, thankfully, in the first hour of the show that came from three Black women. Ayo Debri won Best Supporting Actress in a Comedy for The Bear. Quinta Brunson won Best Lead Actress in a Comedy Series for Abbott Elementary. And Niecy Nash-Betts won Best Supporting Actress in an Anthology Series for Dahmer, Monster, the Jeffrey Dahmer Story. Here's a little of Niecy's speech.
My better half who picked me up when I was gutted from this work. Thank you. And you know who I want to thank? I want to thank me for believing in me and doing what they said I could not do. And I want to say to myself in front of all you beautiful people, go on, girl, with your bad self. You did that. Finally, I accept this award on behalf of every Black and brown woman who has gone unheard yet over-policed, like Glenda Cleveland, like Sandra Bland, like Breonna Taylor. As an artist, my job is to speak truth to power, and baby, I'ma do it to the day I die. Mama, I won!
Say more about this trio of winners and winning shows.
Yeah, I mean, what a great speech that was. You can just hear the joy in her voice and just how moved she is by that win. And I think Quinta Brunson and Ayo Edebiri, who you also mentioned, had that same feeling. You know, Quinta was in tears giving her speech. And that's what you turn in for to award shows for. You know, you want to see these kind of unscripted moments of gratitude or passion or whatever it is that someone wants to express. And it was interesting because there was a little bit they tried to do on the Emmys where they had Anthony Anderson, who was hosting, they had his mama in the audience, like trying to keep people's speeches tight and cutting them off if they went too long. And I felt like some people felt a little bit rushed and a little bit nervous about maybe being told to stop talking by Anthony's mama. But none of those women did. and it was a funny bit, but on the other hand, like, I don't care. Like, let Jennifer Coolidge talk for 5 minutes about whatever comes into her head. That's what I'm here for. Mm-hmm. So I think leaning into that as well is a smart thing for award shows to do.
I know personally, I'd love to hear them talk a little bit more. If they want to talk a little bit more, let them talk a little bit more. Don't hook them off the stage. But that's just me.
No, it's not. It's us and a lot of other people.
Yeah, yeah. I want to talk about The Bear. Season one of FX's The Bear took home 6 Emmys, best comedy series among them. We're going to listen to a clip from episode 7 titled Review. It was filmed in one take, and it has the voices of all 3 actors who won Emmys, Jeremy Allen White, Ayo Edebiri, and Eben Moss-Bachrach.
Ibra, make sandwiches. Don't stop making sandwiches.
Yes, chef.
I'm going to make 3 sections, okay? They're going to be wet, hot, and sweet, all right? I'm going to take green tape, make those sections. Louis, yes, I want you to get the sandwiches, put them in the corresponding sections. Copy?
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Yo, sweet, bag, Sharpie, label that, please, chef.
Yes, chef.
Martina, fire every single chicken we have, please, okay? Yes, Richie, chef. Do you even know how to do fries?
Yes, I know we need them now.
Okay, Marcus, where are we on cakes?
Get in there.
So talk to us about The Bear. Why was this first season so successful? What made it good?
Well, I think you can hear in that clip, that episode won the Emmy for Best Directing. And it's only 20 minutes long, but it is 20 minutes that just puts you in a kitchen, as you can tell from what they were saying, and makes you feel like you're there and is so intense and stressful. Now, if you work in a kitchen, I don't know that you want to come home and watch that after work necessarily, but it's just a very well done piece of work that speaks to what The Bear does so well, which is put you in that restaurant and make you feel like you know all of these characters. So what's interesting about The Bear, as you just said, is that that was for the first season, which again, speaking to the time lapse, like that, we've already watched the second season. Like the second season came out like half a year ago. So by the time we're talking about season one of this on the Emmys, we're like already looking forward to season three. But I do think that dropping season two when they did, when Emmy voters were voting, I think not that the first season wasn't great, but I do think it bumped that show up in the minds of the voters and in the estimation of the voters. And I do think it definitely helped them get a lot of Emmys because of that.
We're talking about the Emmys and new TV with Jen Chaney, TV critic for Vulture and New York Magazine. And we would love to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have? Are you a True Detective fan, Fargo, White Lotus? Maybe share your thoughts on the most recent seasons. Does the cast change-up method work for you? We're going to be talking about that in just a few minutes. Would you rather series producers stick with the same cast? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page and email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Shereen Seward in for Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with TV critic Jen Chaney from Vulture and New York Magazine. We're looking at the Emmys and their future, as well as series convention-busting shows and picks for the coming season. And you can join at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jen, you've written about some new TV that's out, including a fourth season of the highly addictive and rabbit hole-inducing series True Detective. What's the general setup for this latest installment of the franchise?
Yeah, this is True Detective kind of went away for a little while, and now it's back. Issa Lopez has taken over as showrunner, and she directed and co-wrote really all of the episodes. And it's set in Ennis, Alaska. Stars Jodie Foster as a detective who lives in Ennis, this fictional town, where there is an Arctic research station where something very odd happens early in the first episode. All of the scientists who work there wind up dead, and we're not sure what was really going on, how they died, whether they might have that somehow might be tied to a previous murder case that happened. And so Jodie Foster's character has to team up with Kelly Reese, who plays a cop that she used to work with, and try to get to the bottom of it. There are a lot of direct kind of references back to the mythology that was established all the way back in season one of the show with Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. And it's just incredibly atmospheric and suspenseful. And just, I think this is the scariest season of True Detective. Like, there are some moments that are truly, truly creepy and get under your skin. And I think it's just terrific.
I haven't watched the new installment. It's on my list for this weekend, but I've watched the other ones, and I'm curious how much of a connection there is to those early episodes.
Well, I think obviously what's very different here is that it's much more focused on female characters, and you have a woman kind of running the show at this point. So that's different. But in terms of the general structure, I'm going to go back to season one. You've got two cops that don't necessarily get along, trying to solve a case that also opens up previous cases for them. So that's sort of the same. But more importantly, and again, this speaks to the rabbit holes you were alluding to. Mm-hmm. If you remember back to that season with the Yellow King killer and the symbol, the swirl symbol that used to show up, and that's all in this season. It all shows up again. And you're like, oh, my God, is it all connected?
Oh, and sure.
Yeah, and then you start talking about time being a flat circle, and then it's just over for you pretty much. So that's what you got to look forward to.
Well, True Detective has not only a different story, but a different set of lead actors in each season, as we said. White Lotus also tried this between its first and second seasons, and Fargo also generally has a new set of cast members for each season. Is that coincidence, or do you think TV producers are kind of onto something, that this is a new way of doing things?
I mean, it's It's a new way, and it's also a very, very old way, because what we're describing is an anthology series, which is the type of show that every episode is a different story, or every season is a different story. And that dates back all the way to like the Twilight Zone, which is really the godfather of this type of genre. That was every episode being a different story. This is a whole season. And so it kind of allows them to kind of feel like a continuing series, in the sense that, like in the example I just gave with True Detective, there is some connective tissue. Like, it's helpful to have seen the previous seasons, but also if you haven't, you can easily follow the story. So I think it's a great way of kind of breaking through at a time when there's so much TV to say, hey, this is for you if we've watched this before, but it's also for you if you haven't. And then I think it also speaks to the same reason that limited series have done so well in this sort of peak TV and now post-peak TV era, because you can do a season of a show and you can get some really high caliber actors and filmmakers and maybe a better amount of money if you know it's only going to be 6 episodes or 8 episodes and everybody can commit to that time period and then go do a movie or go do some other TV show. So I think you've also seen just a higher level of talent eager to sign on for these kinds of seasons. And that's why you're getting such great TV because of it.
Do you feel like you lose anything not having viewers form these long-lasting relationships with characters as they did with, like, Tony Soprano or, you know, any of those shows that were so long-running and you felt sad when they went away? I don't know. Is it a mixed bag?
Yeah, I think it's a mixed bag. And I think that there's room on television and streaming services for both of those experiences. I do feel like, to your point, there has been a lot of nostalgia lately for the old way of doing things when we watched seasons of a show and there were 24 episodes in each season. And by the time it was all over, you felt like these people were your family. You maybe don't get that experience as much from an anthology series, but you do get tighter storytelling, you get some really strong performances, and you get some really memorable television as well. So I think there is absolutely still a place for long-running series that you can make those kinds of connections to, and also this kind of storytelling as well. I think both can succeed and be really great.
You know, circling back to the Emmys, they did this thing that they brought together some reunions. And I mean, do you think that really ties into that feeling of emotional attachment that you get when you watch a series for so long? Is that why those kinds of features are so compelling?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, they did these kind of set pieces honoring some older shows. The Sopranos was one of them, as you mentioned, even going back to like All in the Family and Good Times. And the reason those shows loom so large in the memory for those of us who are old enough to actually remember watching them when they were on, is because of what you just said. We are connected to the characters. The theme songs were really good. We don't have that anymore. And I do wonder, like, I don't know, 10, 15 years from now, if we're all still here and we're also having the Emmys, like, are they gonna be like, hey, it's a reunion of that one season of True Detective that you guys watched 15 years ago? Is it gonna mean the same thing?
Right.
probably not.
Probably not. But
the other thing, Doreen, is that like in the 70s and 80s and even 90s, there were so fewer TV options and so many people were watching TV as a collective that those memories are much more universal than I think anything will be around TV shows from now, because we watch in much smaller packs than we used to. And we're not all watching the same thing at the same time.
Well, we've got a couple of minutes left, and I want to give you an opportunity to talk about the shows you're most excited about with new TV coming out. I know one, the new Capote versus the Swans is one that you mentioned. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, this is another example of what we're talking about, an anthology series. Ryan Murphy has famously done several of those. American Horror Story is one, American Crime Story is another, and then Feud he had only done one season of. And that was the Bette Davis versus Joan Crawford season. And now this one is looking at the relationship between Truman Capote and his quote unquote swans, these very elite women in New York who he eventually had a major falling out with. And it's got a great cast, just a number of amazing women here, Diane Lane, Demi Moore, Molly Ringwald, Calista Flockhart, Sarah Paulson, who's always in Ryan Murphy shows.
Yeah.
So it's a really, really great cast. I don't know that it like sustains itself fully enough throughout all of its episodes, but it does have a really promising start, and that kicks off next week I believe, on the 31st of January on FX.
And the fourth season of Genius is one that you mentioned as well.
Yeah, again, another example of an anthology series. And I feel like a lot of people maybe aren't even aware of this one as much. It's a Nat Geo series where each one is sort of each season is like a mini series biopic. So they've done Albert Einstein. That was the first season. They've done Aretha Franklin. And this season they're doing Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. I haven't actually had an opportunity to watch this yet. I'm a little dubious just because I feel like their stories have been told so many times that I'm curious to see what different is going to be added to this. But again, it's another example of how we really are seeing a lot of anthology series on TV at the moment.
All right. Our last 30 seconds, I have to ask you. You're stranded on a desert island. You can take one program with you, like one series to last you for the rest of your life. What can you watch over and over and over again?
You know, I'm going to say this because I have watched some of these episodes like 800 times and I can watch them over and over again. And there's a lot of them. The Simpsons.
The Simpsons. There you have it. Jen, thank you so much for joining us today. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Jen Chaney is a TV critic for Vulture at New York Magazine. We talked to her today about evolving the Emmys and exciting TV series breaking the conventional formats.